You are. How you doing, everybody? Morning, afternoon, evening. About to launch into one of my favorite subjects, physics in general, and time travel, of course, being part of that. Sean Carroll is a senior research associate in physics at the California Institute of Technology. His research involves theoretical physics and astrophysics, focusing on issues in cosmology, field theory, and gravitation. His current research involves models of dark matter and dark energy, cosmological modifications of Einstein's general relativity, theory of relativity, the physics of inflationary cosmology, and the origin of time. He has received research grants from NASA, the Department of Energy, and the National Science Foundation, as well as fellowships from the Sloan and Packard Foundations. This is going to be a very, very interesting interview. So if you're one of those who wonders what more there is to all of us, you're going to want to stay right where you are. In a moment, Sean Carroll. Sean Carroll, welcome to the program.
Hi, Art.
Welcome. It's great to have you. I see that you apparently have some interest yourself in time. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the things we study, trying to understand how the universe works.
It's a passion of mine. What to a physicist, which you are, what does time mean? It's a wonderful first question. What does time mean?
Well, it's a loaded question because it means more than one thing. One of the things that we understand about time that we didn't used to is that there's more than one definition that works. So there's a sort of universal time that we think of as labeling places in the universe. If you want to meet somebody for coffee, you need to tell them what time you're going to meet them. Just like you have to give them a position, you also have to give them a time. But then there's also a personal time. There's the amount of time that you measure as elapsing if you pay attention to your wristwatch as you walk along. And in the old days, we used to think these were the same, but now we know better. They can be different from each other. And then finally, there's a sort of more familiar notion of time as something that flows, something that changes, something that passes us by, which physicists relate to entropy and thermodynamics, and that is something we understand parts of, and other parts still remain a mystery.
Is time a real thing, or is it our invention?
I think time is pretty real as concepts in physics get. What is really real is space-time, which is how Einstein taught us to describe the whole universe all at once, and time's a big part of that. Because you and I and all of our friends move slowly with respect to each other compared to the speed of light, we have a fairly uniform notion of what time is. But really what's out there, if you want to talk about what's real and what's not, what's real is space-time, the whole four-dimensional place where we live.
When we talk about space-time, do you mean, for example, how long it would take us to travel to Alpha Centauri at the speed of light?
Well, that's right. Those notions are closely related. What I mean, though, is really just the simple idea that, you know, we could have been talking about back long before Einstein, when Isaac Newton was our leading authority when it came to time, which is just that if, again, you want to meet somebody, if you want to specify some place in the universe, and you want to see somebody else there, you need to give them four numbers. You need to give them three numbers saying where they are in space, let's say their latitude, longitude, and height above the ground. But you also need to tell them what time you're going to meet them there. Otherwise, you'll be there at the wrong moment, and they're not going to be there to see you. So it takes four numbers to specify a location in the universe. And those four numbers are what we call the four coordinates on space-time. So it's really just nothing more deeply complicated than that, just the fact that space and time are both parts of what makes up the universe. And then how space and time mix together to create space-time gets tied up with this question of what we would experience if we zoomed out to Alpha Centauri near the speed of light.
Okay, let me ask you this. Many listeners have asked me this, and I'm never quite sure how to answer it. If time travel were possible to go to the past or go to the future, and we had a machine to accomplish this, many listeners have called and said, well, look, the Earth is in orbit around the sun. The Earth is moving. So if we traveled in time, is there any chance that instead of ending up, you know, in the same place on Earth, only at a different time, we would end up in a different time, all right, but perhaps out in the vacuum of space where Earth once was or will be or isn't?
Well, yeah, in fact, it's more than a possibility. It's practically a necessity. One of the things that we have to understand when we start talking about traveling through time is that traveling through time is something that we all do all the time, as it were. Namely, we move to the future at a rate of 1 minute per minute, whether we like it or not.
Yes.
And in space-time language, that means that you and I and everybody else describes a path, a trajectory through space-time, and that is continuous. We don't ever sort of poof out of existence in one place and poof into existence some other place, in space or in time. We're always having a smooth trajectory. Where we were right now is very closely connected to where we were a fraction of a second ago. So if you want to talk about traveling backwards in time, what it really means is traveling through space and having space be configured in such a nice way to allow us to do a loop so that we come back before we left. So if you build a real time machine, if it were possible, we don't know if it's possible or not, actually.
It would have to bend space, essentially.
Well, it would require two elements. One thing, you would need something that bent space and time together. You need a strong gravitational field.
Right.
To warp space and time to allow for travel backwards in time, or at least, you know, to allow for travel that brought you to your own past. But then you would need to actually make that journey. So you need some object that made you travel through space, namely a rocket ship or something like that. So the crucial point is that you would not jump in the machine, the lights would flash, smoke would come out, and you would disappear to arrive at some other point. You would blast off in your rocket ship, and to you, time is moving forward 1 minute per minute. But then you go in your rocket ship in the right way, and eventually, 2 weeks later, you come back, and there you are, looking at yourself in the pad, ready to have that little rocket be launched.
Sorry, are you saying that...
What would be like if it were possible?
You're saying then that you think time travel via the science fiction machine is not possible.
That's right. If time travel is possible, and I want to keep saying if, it would look like space travel. It would look like space travel under certain very specific circumstances. That's right.
Well, what about if we are able to create a black hole? Now, they're working on that little idea at CERN.
That's right.
Albeit a very tiny little one at the moment, but suppose they were able to create a substantial black hole, aside from the possible catastrophic results of doing such a thing. if we could create a black hole, then one would think that that could be incorporated into some sort of machine, which would allow you to get near its event horizon and zip from one time to another, essentially.
Well, it's related, but it's not the same thing. And so, in fact, if we made a black hole in the conventional way, if one can speak of such things, we don't make black holes every day, but the universe makes black holes every day. Stars explode and collapse and form black holes. And what would happen if we stayed far outside and a friend of ours zoomed in close to the black hole but didn't enter, stayed there for a while and came back, is that if, from our point of view, much more time would have passed than from their point of view. So if anything, a black hole is a machine that will take you into the future even faster. So if you turn it around and you zoom close to the event horizon and you hover there for a moment and you come back, to you only a day has passed, but to the rest of the world it's been 500 years.
Are we sure that black holes really do exist? Are we positive about that now?
We're pretty close to positive. We never get to be 100% positive in science at all, and certainly not in astronomy. Our theories predict that they exist. They make certain very firm predictions for how we should be able to perceive them in terms of X-rays coming out in the vicinity of black holes and so forth. And those predictions come true. We see things that look exactly like we think black holes should look. In fact, at the center of our galaxy, the center of the Milky Way galaxy, you can see movies that have been made by people taking pictures of the stars at the center of our galaxy over a course of years, and you see that these stars are not moving in straight lines. They're moving in orbits around something that is big and dark and not shining. And you can figure out from the distance to the center of the galaxy and so forth how much mass there must be in that big dark thing, and it's a million times the mass of the sun. The only thing we know that that can be is a black hole.
So it must be there.
Either that or something even better.
Even better. What would you guess would be in the category of even better?
Well, what is certainly there, and certainly elsewhere in the universe in other examples, are very large concentrations of mass in very small regions of space. So according to general relativity, according to Einstein's theory of gravity, the only thing those can be are black holes. If they're not black holes, that means that Einstein was not right. And that means that gravity is described in some way that we don't yet understand, and therefore we would have to understand that to understand what these things are. And that's what physicists love, when you discover something out there in the universe that our current theories don't quite explain perfectly. But so far, I should say that our theories are explaining things quite well. Everything that we see in astrophysical situations near black hole candidates is quite consistent with what Einstein predicted.
So gravity, that which keeps our feet on the ground, and so forth and so on, is mass.
Gravity is created by mass. What gravity is the curvature of space-time. So that's why gravity comes involved when you want to make a time machine, because gravity is a manifestation of the fact that space and time are not like Euclid thought they were, with triangles having 180-degree angles inside, et cetera, everything you learned in high school. But mass and other forms of energy actually warp space and time into each other.
So the Earth warps space and time.
Absolutely. Otherwise, we would all float away.
And creates the gravity that keeps our feet on the ground.
That's right.
And a black hole, of course, is it's so many million times stronger than the gravity produced by Earth. And a black hole is a collapsed star, correct?
Well, a collapsing star is the simplest way to make a black hole. The black hole at the center of our galaxy, which is a million times the mass of the sun, is started out as a collapsed star or some similarly catastrophic event, but then accreted a lot of the matter in its neighborhood and just grew and grew over the last few billion years into the size we see it today.
Is it going to be possible, in your opinion, to create at CERN, for example, a black hole, even a small black hole, even a very sort of temporary, very quick black hole? Is it going to be possible?
I would bet against it if you gave me odds. It's something that we all hope would be true because it would be so fascinating. We would learn a lot. And it's also certainly respectable as an idea to think about. It's one of the sort of more speculative theories that are taken seriously, but it definitely is taken seriously. And that's why you have to do the experiment, because you don't know ahead of time.
If we do the experiment and if we create a black hole, giving me a straight on answer, is there any danger in doing that?
No.
Potential danger?
No, not at all.
Why?
Well, there's two reasons. There's the wimpy reason and there's the extremely strong reason. The wimpy reason is that everything that we understand or think to understand about black holes says that even if you make one, it will very quickly evaporate. It will just disappear. And now you might say, well, maybe we don't know what's going on, and that's true. On the other hand, the things that are going to be happening at the particle accelerator at CERN, so in Geneva, outside Geneva, CERN, the particle accelerator is going to be turning on next year, going to be reaching energies that we've never reached before in experiments here on Earth,
right?
But have been reached many times elsewhere in the universe, all the time. you have protons and other particles colliding into each other elsewhere in the universe, nothing dramatic happens. So we know that whatever happens might be interesting to us, but it's not going to be some cataclysm. And also, you know, you should emphasize that black holes are, the important thing about a black hole is not that its gravity is strong, but that it's small. So if our sun, if all the mass of our sun tomorrow turned into a black hole, the Earth would not be sucked into it. The Earth would go along in its orbit exactly as it always has because we're far away. There's just no more or less gravity if you turn the sun into a black hole than it already has.
Well, so, all right, let me give you something to potentially worry about.
Okay.
So a black hole could be potentially very small and very powerful, right?
Powerful on microscopic scales. It really would not be that powerful. If a black hole that size went by your nose right now, you would never notice.
Uh-huh. So
we're talking about something, you know, it's powerful by microscopic standards, but the black holes you'd be creating are less than a trillionth of a gram in mass.
You're talking about the ones that CERN might make.
CERN, yeah.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah.
But here's my question. We all know about the massive black holes that astronomers think they have identified.
Mm-hmm.
Could there be a scale of black holes? In other words, could there be a black hole, a tenth the size of our Earth, for example? Could there be varying black holes, a smaller, relatively smaller black hole? And is it possible that these black holes are not in absolutely fixed orbits? In other words, could there be marauding black holes?
That's a good question, and part of me wants to say it's certainly possible. It is certainly possible if you don't tell me how many of them there are. It's certainly possible that in our galaxy there's a handful of black holes the size, the mass of the Earth going through. And, you know, how would we know? We would never know. It wouldn't be any different, as far as we're concerned, from a bunch of planets the size of the Earth going around. Because, like I said,
I guess what I'm asking is, if one of these marauding black holes, should they exist, were to collide with the Earth or another planet similar in size to ours,
right,
what would the result of that be?
It would be a mess. However, you said, you know, could these things exist? And I said yes, but the number of these things is going to be much less than the number of good old-fashioned planet-sized things, planet-sized planets in the galaxy and in the universe. And if another Earth-sized planet ran into us, it would be equally, if not more, disastrous to the Earth.
Really?
And that's not very likely. So these are not in my top 10 list of things to worry about over the next 100 years.
Uh-huh. Okay. From time to time, we see these incredible, you know, I'm a sun watcher. I'm a ham radio operator, have been all my life, since I've been 13 years old. And so I watch the sun very carefully. And occasionally we've been getting these incredible gamma bursts that just come from not our sun, but apparently seem to come from deep space. Now, I don't know what causes these giant gamma ray bursts, but they certainly affect radio transmission. And they are real, and where are they coming from? And is it possible that you could get a gamma ray burst that would be so strong, so big, that it would be damaging to life on Earth?
Well, I have to make a parenthetical comment here. There are gamma ray bursts that astrophysicists are fascinated by that exist throughout the universe. We've been studying very much for the last 20 years. I can't imagine that they affect radio signals here on Earth very much. They're extremely powerful if you're close by, but they're so far away that we need to strain with our best telescopes just to notice them at all. However, like you imply, if one happened nearby, it would be lights out for us, depending on how nearby was. What we're thinking in terms of these gamma ray bursts is something like a supernova or something like two black holes.
Yes.
Coalescing with each other by giving off gravitational radiation and then unleashing a huge explosion of energy. So we could have one of these elsewhere in our galaxy and we'd be okay. It would be quite the show in the sky, but there wouldn't be any noticeable effect on our lives. But if one happened you know, as close as the nearest star, that would be something else.
All right. Hold it right there. Sean Carroll is my guest. Physics, the subject, time travel, sort of interwoven into all of this, but we'll go all over the place. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. Actually, that's very well sung. Time keeps flowing like a river to the sea. My guest, Sean Carroll, is a research associate in physics at the California Institute of Technology. His research revolving around theoretical physics and astrophysics, focusing on issues in cosmology, field theory, and gravitation. Just the right fellow to be talking about exactly what we're discussing. Back to Sean Carroll in a moment. So then, Dr. Carroll, I didn't say anything about that. I figured it had to be doctor. It is doctor. Welcome back. Doctor, you know, so a time machine is impossible with what we know, the known laws of physics. But how about this? There's this new quantum thing that I've been trying to get my head, and a lot of other people have, wrapped around for a long time. This quantum world where apparently a particle... here and a particle there in North America where you are can interact at exactly the same time. Now, Einstein said something about, I'm paraphrasing here, goofy interaction at a distance. He didn't like it. He understood it.
He called it spooky.
Yeah, that's it. Spooky interaction at a distance. He didn't like it because it didn't fit in, and it does indeed seem to violate everything. In other words, it wouldn't matter whether these two particles were Philippines to North America or North America to Alpha Centauri, they would interact at the same time. Now, that necessitates communication. You just simply can't have a coordinated movement without a communication occurring. Maybe at some level that we don't possibly understand yet, but it exceeds the speed of light. However it's happening, it's bending all the rules, which I guess explains why he didn't like it, because he loves rules. Loved rules.
Well, okay, there's a couple things. One is that, the good news is that your first statement, that according to the current laws of physics, time travel is impossible, is actually a bit too strong. I think according to the current laws of physics, it's an open question. It might not be possible, but we can get into the details of that without worrying about spooky quantum mechanics, if you like. But as far as the spooky entanglements are concerned, I really think that there we're simply being misled by the fact that the English language and all the other languages in the world were not developed in order to talk about quantum mechanics. And we're being misled by words, even though what's going on is not that spooky at all. In particular, the phenomenon of entanglement of two particles that are separated by large distances doesn't violate any rules at all, but it makes us nervous. But making us nervous is not one of the laws of physics.
Wait a minute. That's
make us nervous.
Getting nervous does not properly explain. There has to be a communication.
There has to be. See, that's the thing.
Tell me how there doesn't.
Well, here's the point. I have a particle here in Los Angeles, and you have a particle there in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And the rules are that if you ask me, is this particle spinning clockwise or counterclockwise, I cannot give you an answer. I just don't know until I observe it. And likewise for your particle over there. However, there is another rule that says if I do observe my particle and I find that it is going clockwise, then I can predict with 100% certainty that yours will be going counterclockwise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But so what? How do I possibly use that to send a signal to you? I mean, if I observe my particle and I decide that it's clockwise, then I know for a fact that yours is counterclockwise, but I can't do anything with it. There's nothing that helps me send a signal to you. So it makes us nervous, but there's no possible way that I can use it to send information faster than the speed of light.
Yet.
Ever.
Ever?
You can prove a theorem, actually, yes. All of this spookiness is, Einstein wrote a paper about this, a famous paper, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, and the point of his paper was, look, here is the prediction of quantum mechanics according to its rules, and I don't like it, it makes me nervous, therefore there must be something missing. So we've moved a little bit beyond that now, and we've looked at this a lot, and we've thought about it, we've done the experiment, and it's true, and we realize, you know, here is the prediction of quantum mechanics, and it's true, and we have to learn to deal with it, because that's what nature is like, and nevertheless, one of the rules that it is obeying says that we can't send information faster than the speed of light. It's perfectly consistent with that rule.
I don't understand that. The two particles have to be communicating to, in other words, a movement of one sort. They can actually manipulate these particles. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, like I said, they've done the experiment. But you need to tell me how I can possibly make use of the fact that if my particle is going clockwise, yours is going counterclockwise.
I can't. I'm not the guest.
Yeah. Well, then,
it is not sufficient to say that, in my opinion, that, it happens, and we just have to learn to deal with it. It's our job to understand why it happens. It seems like there has to be a communication. I'm not trying to be rude here. It just how can one do a flip and the other do a flop without the flopper knowing there's been a flip?
Well, that's because we're used to thinking in, like I said, classical terms. Classical is what we called the laws of physics before quantum mechanics came along. According to classical mechanics, there would be no way for this entanglement to exist over a long way. But this whole story that we're telling of me looking at my particle and seeing it going clockwise, and then instantaneously your particle is counterclockwise, that's the part that is a bit of a fake. That's the part that our language is letting us down. Because what I said, when I was very careful, I didn't say that instantaneously when I observed my particle, your particle was going counterclockwise. I said that now I knew with 100% certainty that if you observed yours, you would see it to be going counterclockwise. So there is no need for a signal to travel. There's a consistent history of the world in which I observe my particle, you observe your particle, and the laws of quantum mechanics tell us that tomorrow, when one of us flies across the ocean to visit and we exchange notes, we realized that one of our particles was going clockwise and the other was going counterclockwise, and it's completely useless in terms of sending a signal.
Right now. But you will say it will always be so.
According to the rules as we understand them right now. So, I mean, I'm always, there's two different things that we do in physics. One is take the laws of physics as we understand them and tell you what they predict, but the other is wonder if those laws are correct and wonder if we can move beyond them. According to the laws as we understand them right now, the same laws that predicted this crazy phenomenon, you cannot use this crazy phenomenon to send information faster than the speed of light.
Okay, I guess. It still seems like there has to be a communication that is occurring at what exceeds the speed of light, virtually instantaneously. This is happening. Now there's an entanglement. Can you explain to me the manner of entanglement that causes this to happen?
Well, what I would say is that you can tell the story without ever using the idea of instantaneous change across very large distances. So the story is that if you and I both observe our particles and then later we meet up and we ask each other what happened, we will never both be saying that we observed our particles to be going counterclockwise. One of us will get one answer, the other will get the other answer. And then you can say, well, how could that happen? You know, what must have gone past? And I can just say, look, the rules don't say that a little signal had to go from one particle to the other. The rules just say that every time we get together, we will agree that our two particles were spinning in opposite directions.
Okay. Trouble with words. Then what does entanglement Define entanglement in the quantum world for me.
Well, what entanglement means is that if I have a little system right here in front of me that I'm holding in my hand, according to good old classical mechanics, before quantum mechanics came along, if I knew everything that was going on in that system all by itself, and I didn't bother it, I didn't do anything to it, I could predict what would happen at any future time with that system. But entanglement says that systems are not local. Systems are not described as existing just isolated in some point in space. I can have a system that somehow isn't fully described right here in front of me unless I include its relationship to things very, very far away. Which is fun, arguably spooky, but does not let you send signals faster than the speed of light.
Okay. And in your opinion, never will. It's just weird.
That's right. And, you know, it's not, I don't want to dismiss worrying about it because Einstein worried about it, and Einstein was a smart cookie. But we have, since Einstein, sort of learned to understand the consequences of it better, and we've learned to draw sharper distinctions between a set of words that makes it sound as if something is happening instantaneously and the actual thing that is not allowed, which is sending a signal that could be used to carry information faster than the speed of light. And quantum mechanics allows us to use words as if things were happening instantaneously, but it does not allow us to send information faster than the speed of light.
Okay, but this entanglement is happening faster than the speed of light, yes?
Well, this entanglement exists all over the place. And then we come up with a set of words to describe what will happen if we observe part of the entangled system.
Boy, is this confusing.
Well, I hope so. A lot of smart people bounded their head against the walls for decades trying to figure it out. I hate to say it, but it kind of becomes easier if you can write down some equations. I know that's a completely unhelpful answer, but... The we're used to things happening locally. We're used to, you know, if I smack my hand on the desk, sound waves come out from that desk and they move at some speed and it all makes perfect sense to us. Quantum mechanics doesn't quite obey those rules. It really says that the state of me here in this room might be entangled, intertwined in some important way,
yes,
with the state of something very, very far away in the universe.
Indeed,
and that's
so.
Interesting and fascinating, and I do not want to downgrade the amazingness of that statement, but I do want to point out that you can nevertheless show, using the equations, that you can't use that amazingness to send information faster than the speed of light.
All right. When we if we develop quantum mechanics, what uses can you imagine as we develop as we understand more about this spooky thing?
Well, one of the most exciting, plausible technological developments is what we call quantum computing.
Yes.
So if I have my little particle that is either going clockwise or counterclockwise, in classical mechanics, it really is either going clockwise or counterclockwise, but in quantum mechanics, it's doing neither. It's described by a probability that it's doing one thing versus the other thing, all at once. So that one little spinning particle has a lot more information in it. Instead of being either clockwise or counterclockwise, it has 55% being clockwise, 45% being counterclockwise. So that's a lot more information. And if you then take 20 such particles and they're entangled, what that means is that to describe the entire configuration of 20 particles, you need to tell me what is the probability that particle 1 is doing something if particles 2 through 20 are doing something. And it's a tremendous amount of information required just to say what that is. And what that means, basically, is that instead of a complicated hard disk to have, you know, gigabytes of information on it, you need a couple particles. And by doing manipulations on those particles, you can do incredibly complicated calculations quantum mechanically, enormously faster, unimaginably faster than you could do them on a classical computer. And that's an exciting technological development. That's going to be the next quantum leap, if you'll excuse the phrase, in how computers work. They'll be just enormously more powerful once we harness that possibility.
I wonder how a quantum computer developed would compare to the human brain.
The human brain, as amazing as it is relentlessly classical. It does not, as far as anyone knows, and this is, a tiny bit uncertain, but I think there's no reason to think, that the human brain takes advantage of quantum mechanical possibilities. Quantum mechanics, even though it's amazing, is also a little bit delicate. If you tend to take this, one of these systems of two particles far away that are entangled with each other and bump into one of them by accident, it all collapses and the entanglement goes away.
Yes.
Our brains are being bumped into all the time, so they remain sort of pure and unentangled. So as far as anyone knows, the human brain just takes advantage of the fact that it's a complicated but relatively mundane system of neurons hooked up together in a very highly interconnected way.
So, Doctor, then you're probably saying that a quantum computer would make a human brain look like an abacus.
Well, it's not a very good comparison, right? I mean, my calculator wristwatch makes me look kind of stupid if you're trying to multiply two five-digit numbers together, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But if I'm trying to cook a nice meal, I will win. So all of these comparisons of raw computing power to the human brain are a little bit misleading. It's not the hardware that is the trick, it's the software.
Yes, indeed, the software. One of the holy grails, of course, of computers is eventually AI. In other words, some sort of artificial intelligence. How would you say that moment of artificial intelligence would actually be measured? When would we know that we have achieved something beyond just a faster computer with more storage? Something that knows that it exists?
This is a great question. I'm going to wimp out and say I have no idea how we would answer that precise question. But I will go so far as to say that when something like that happens, when computer power advances to the point where we're beginning to talk about true artificial intelligence, the kind of intelligence we will get will look very different than human intelligence. Not just that it'll have different wants and needs and feelings of justice and beauty, but that it will be really good at some things and really not so good at other things. The human brain is not something that a set of engineers wrote up a little code to make. It's the result of billions of years of evolution of neurochemical processes, et cetera, et cetera. And it's specialized for certain tasks. And we don't yet know how to encode, how to reproduce those specialties. So we might get a computer that is very good at playing chess or playing poker and not very good at frying eggs or the other way around. So I think we should be surprised. We will be surprised at what computers can do well quickly and what computers nevertheless remain very dumb at doing as the future progresses.
How do you feel about the possibility of humans increasingly being entangled with computers? In other words, boy, we're beginning to get people who are actually connecting their nerve endings to computers in, albeit very, I suppose early and raw ways, but it's leading to a world, not too many years down the line, where we're going to be kind of part human, part machine, if we wish it.
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, the first steps are very clear with simple things like pacemakers and artificial limbs, right? And this is just one of those areas, I have to confess, that nobody has ever correctly predicted what the future will look like, even 50 years down the line, much less 100 or 1,000. 100 years ago, I mean, I think the correct thing to think of when you're trying to answer these questions is what people would have said 100 years ago if you asked them the same question. And they would have said, what, a computer? What is that? And so 100 years from now, we're not going to be talking about human beings interfacing with computers. There'll be some other entirely new concept that is analogous to a computer, but is, we're not even dreaming of right now, that everyone will be wondering, how will that change how human beings live? So I'm very, fascinated and excited by the possibilities, but I'm completely pessimistic about my own or anybody else's ability to predict what will happen next.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the the future of the human race. Now, I frequently interviewed other theoretical physicists who are, when you really pin them down, awfully pessimistic about the possibility of our evolving past Michio Kaku, for example, says past a type zero planet, which he says we are right now, to a type one planet. He feels that we will ultimately blow ourselves to smithereens. We'll tackle that one when we get back from the break, which we're right on top of right now. I just looked up and poof, all that time is gone. Dr. Sean Carroll is my guest. I'm Art Bell from Manila, the Philippines.